glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Guru.
Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pujara Sasasimam Vasutara Stani Nandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutapadkamam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Chan Sri Rupam Sadhvajatam Sadhana Raghunatam Rupam Tamsajivam Sadhvaitam Sadhvaditam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahana Mamitam Sri Shakam Vichastra
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Uvacha, Jambudvipasticara, Jan Upadvipam Asto Haika Upadistanti, Sagar Atmajar Asvan Veshana, Imam Mahim Parito Nekanadbir, Upakalpitam Tadyata, Swarnaprastas, Chandrasukla, Avartino Ramanko, Mandara Harina, Panchajanya, Shimhalo, Lankati. Shri Suka Uvacha.
Shri
Sukadev Goswami continued to speak. Jambudvipasya. Of the island known as Jambudvip.
Of the island known as Jambudvip.
Cha.
Also.
Rajan.
Rajan.
O king.
Upadvipam
Astau.
Upadvipam
Astau. Eight subordinate islands.
Eight subordinate islands.
Ha. Certainly.
AK.
Some. Upadishanti.
Learned scholars describe.
Sagara Atmajai. By the sons of Maharaj Sagara.
Asva
Anveshane.
While
trying to find their lost horse.
Imam.
This.
Mahim.
Tract of land,
Paritaha,
all around,
Nikhanadvi,
digging,
Upakalpitan,
created,
tat,
that,
yata,
as follows,
Swarnaprastaha,
Swarnaprasta,
Chandrasukla,
Chandrasukla,
Avartana,
Avartana,
Avartana.
Ramanaka.
Ramanaka.
These are all the places they read. Mandara Harinaha.
Mandara Harinaha.
Mandara Harinaha.
Harinaha.
Panchajanya.
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 Simhala.
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 Lanka.
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 Iti.
Iti.
Thus. Anybody can name the places they created? Any of the places that the sons of Sagara created? Oh, they're up there on the board? Oh. Oh. So everybody's eyes went on the board. Okay. I was trying to see if I should listen. Our translation in purport, my Srila Prabhupada. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, "My dear king, in the opinion of some learned scholars," and that's an interesting statement because that means that not everybody agrees. Some people say, and some people say something different. And we'll often find this. even in Bhagavatam, even in the purport. Sometimes some of the acharyas say one thing, and some of the acharyas say another thing. In the opinion of some learned scholars, 8 smaller islands surrounding Jambudvip. In the opinion of some, 8 smaller islands surround Jambudvip. When the sons of Mahasagara were searching all over the world for their lost horse, they dug up the earth, and in this way, 8 adjoining islands came into existence. The names of these islands are Swarnaprastha, Chandrasupla, Avartana, Ramanka, Mandarharina, Panchajanya, Simla, and Lanka. So do you all remember the story before we went to the purport? Do you all remember the story of the sons digging up the earth? Everybody else all remember that story? Or should we give that like a couple minute review? Okay, so we go back a little. This Mahasagara, we'll go back a bit. Mahasagara is interesting. His father and a number of his wives had taken Vanaprastha. They were living in the forest. And the father died. And there were no children. And so one of the wives was going to enter into the fire with her husband's dead body, and some sages stopped her and said, "You're pregnant." So she didn't enter the fire. And the other wives were so upset that only this one wife was going to continue the dynasty that they gave her poison. And the poison didn't act. It didn't hurt either her or the child. And in fact, it said the child was born along with the poison. Sagara, he's born with the poison. So that was Mahasagara. And Mahasagara had... These kings are really interested in their, you know, they're going to continue the dynasty. They're going to be the most powerful. They're going to be the ones. Like Dhritarashtra, the whole battle of Kurukshetra was over. Who's going to be the king? That's foolishness. As Virajendra who says, our whole life is 8 billionths of a second for Lord Brahma, you know. Who's going to be the king for 8 billionths of a second? So, Sagara had 2 wives, and when they wanted to have children, they were asked by some sages, well, all right, one of you can have 60,000 children that will not continue the dynasty, and the other of you will have 1 child that will continue the dynasty. So, who wants what? So, one of the wives said, I'll take the 60,000 that won't continue the dynasty, and the other wife said, I'll take the one that will continue the dynasty. So when Mahasagara was performing a horse sacrifice, the horse was stolen by Indra. He does that. Now, we shouldn't think that just because we're devotees or we're pious or we're saintly, that there's never going to be anybody envious of us. I was just reading at the end of the Majjhalila, Krishnadas Kaviraj is saying that the Chaitanya Charitamrita is not going to be appreciated by people who are like hogs and dogs. And Prabhupada said, obviously, people were critical of Krishnadas Kaviraj writing the Chaitanya Charitamrita. They were criticizing his work. And Prabhupada said, what to speak of someone like myself, speaking about himself. He was so insignificant compared to Krishnadas Kaviraj. So sometimes we become very surprised when people are criticizing, or people are envious, or people are saying this or that, or people are trying to impede our service. But this happens even with great personalities. When Sagar is trying to do a service, and Indra, who's another devotee, and should be helping him, because we find this, isn't it? In this kind, you're trying to do something and someone else comes along and impedes your service. And you think, this is not supposed to happen in a society of devotees. But, you know, it happens even with very elevated devotees in this material world. As long as we're not fully pure, there's going to be some residue of envy and maliciousness. It happens. Anyway, so he stole the horse. And the sons of Sagar went out to look for it, and these 60,000 sons, in looking for the horse, they dug up the ocean. They looked everywhere. They couldn't find the horse. And they started digging, and digging, and digging, and digging, and digging, and they dug such a large area that it became an ocean. The ocean is also called Sagara. And it filled with water. And in digging, according to the opinion of some learned scholars, they also created these separate islands. They created these separate parts of land. We know in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, it says that when Gopakumar returned to the earth planet, that other than places like Jagannath Puri and Vrindavan, everything had changed. And Krishna says material nature is endlessly mutable. So even the position of the continents, I mean, the scientists have this theory about continental drift. I don't know if their theory is correct, but the principle is correct, that things are always changing. You know, an island is where my kids live in Hawaii. They live on an active volcano. That's, the island is growing, and there's an island to the east of them that's forming when it wasn't there before. Now it's going to be there. And after a while, of course, islands die. The volcanic island, the mountain sinks into the ocean, and you're just left with an atoll. And so things form. They come into being for some time, and then they disappear. And that's the nature of the world. An island that wasn't there is there. An island that's there is not. So anyway, they form these islands. Of course, the story goes on from there. I'm not going to tell the rest of the story. But so that's what we're talking about here in this verse. And it's being spoken about here because here Sukadeva Goswami is describing the structure of the universe. So here he's talking about, this is a story of how this particular aspect of Jambudvipa came into existence. Now, we also meant, before we go on to the purport, we do really want to look at this thing, and in the opinion of various learned scholars, you know, Prabhupada told us that we should study every verse from, what did he say? Many angles of vision. From many angles of vision. How many meanings of one verse, the Atmarama verse, did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu give? 64. So many meanings, one verse, 64 different meanings. What was 61? Anyway, 60-something meanings of one verse. And yet we often find that people will read this Shastra and say, this is the only meaning. This is the meaning, that's the literal meaning, and there's no other meaning. I remember once reading a letter from one devotee who said, this is what the Shastra said, and that's Krishna's opinion, and anyone who disagrees with it doesn't agree with Krishna. And I thought, is it Krishna's opinion or your understanding of Krishna's opinion that everybody has to agree with? What are you saying? You're saying that you're the Acharya who can give the only possible interpretation of a particular statement of God. You know, you're now God. So this is our tendency. Our tendency is, well, that's what it says. It says this. And therefore, that's what it, what I understand it means is what it means. And it's quite interesting that in our International Society for Krishna Consciousness, we study the scriptures and we learn that conditioned souls have four defects. We have imperfect senses. Sometimes you think you read something and actually it says something different. Oh, it actually says something different. Like I thought it said surrounding and it said surround. And so in imperfect senses, we have a tendency to make mistakes. Which, by the way, Prabhupada defines that in the 18th mantra of Ishopanishad as a tendency to commit unintentional sins. That doesn't mean a tendency to put your shoe on the wrong foot. When we say liberated souls don't make mistakes, we don't mean that they never put their shoe on the wrong foot. In fact, Krishna tries to milk a bull once instead of a cow. And the gopis put their clothes on upside down. So those kind of mistakes are made even by liberated souls in God. Sometimes supposed to milk a bull, Prabhupada says. See, Prabhupada told Tray Rishi, he said, don't look for that kind of utopia. For that doesn't exist even in the spiritual world. But as far as unintentional sins, we have a tendency when we're conditioned to commit intentional sins, we'll speak of unintentional sins. We have a tendency to be illusioned. We think something is something else, and we have a tendency to cheat. So that even if we know the truth, we present something different for our own purposes. And we have a tendency to cheat ourselves also. Right? This is very common, that we're not honest with ourselves. I was having to deal a while ago with a situation where one devotee was very, very critical of some leaders and saying, they covered up abuse just to keep their own reputation. And then after that, somebody wrote an article they posted on the internet about an abuse case that mentioned this person, even though he wouldn't do it, was innocent. And he said, I want to write something to clear my name. And the victim in the case said, I don't want you to write anything on this case. I don't want anybody talking about it. I don't want anybody knowing about it. Just forget it. And he said, no, I'm going to write something to clear my name. And I said to this devotee, well, then it sounds like you're more interested in your own reputation than the feelings of a victim. No, that's just other people. So we have this tendency to cheat ourselves. We have a tendency to think of ourselves differently than other people see us. We have a tendency to think of ourselves differently than the reality, to misjudge our own motivations. And yet, at the same time, even though we know all these things, and even though I think all of us would admit that we're not just in pure prema bhakti, still we tend to take our conclusions and our opinions and our way of looking at things very seriously. know that the way I understand, that the way I understand something is the right understanding. My way of seeing things is truth. Krishna says, in my opinion, says that is my opinion, and we tend to think that about ourselves. This is my opinion, and therefore it's true. I'm working with some group doing some service with the GBC. One of the members said, we should try to envision what ISKCON is going to be like 300 years from now. And I said, in 1978 or 79, if you had told me ISKCON would be the way it is now, I wouldn't have believed you. I said, I would have had no, it was impossible for me to have taken from 79 to 2009, only 30 years. I would not have envisioned the way things are. I said, and I'm supposed to guess what it's going to be like 300 years from now? And then he said, you should write this paper so that 3,000 years from now, the GBC will be thanking you. And I didn't say anything, but I thought, you know, they're really not even going to know my name 3,000 years from now. Or the speaker will be thanking me. So this is our tendency. You know, I'll be able to see the future. I can understand everything. But if we find in the Shastra that different learned scholars, different acharyas, have different points of view. Of course, then we may ask, well, how is it that people can have different points of view about the absolute truth? You ever wonder that? I mean, these are liberated souls. They're not making mistakes. They don't have imperfect senses. They don't have the propensity to cheat. How come they have different opinions? But even in the ultimate reality, there's still individuality and there's still point of view. The subjectivity of this world that causes us so much grief. Now, something happens and I have my story about it and you have your story about it and you have your story about it and we all think our story's right and we fight. And we think if only we could all have exactly the same story about the facts, we'd get along. And so we tend to think that the absolute world must be a world where everybody has the same story about the facts all the time. That's not true. Right? And Mother Yasoda there, when she's waking up Krishna in the morning and she sees that there's dirt on his body and scratches, and she thinks he didn't get a proper bath the night before. And some of the young gopis who are in the room, they're laughing. And they're thinking, no, Krishna, as soon as his parents thought he was asleep, got up in the middle of the night and ran off to do his rasa. That's where the dirt and the scratches came from. So there's two devotees. Mother Yasoda is a pure devotee. The young gopis are pure devotees. They're certain liberated souls. They're above liberated souls. They're seeing the same facts. And Krishna Radharani has switched their cloths by mistake. So Krishna's got a blue cloth on. And Mother Yasoda thinks it's Balaram. She doesn't think it's Radharani. She thinks it's Balaram. So even among the liberated souls, the pure devotees, they sometimes have different stories about the same facts. Happens. So we should not be so surprised, nor should we be so convinced that only our way of seeing things or the particular acharya that we follow is the only one who can explain truth. Ramanujacharya explained things somewhat differently. Madhvacharya explained things somewhat differently. And that's according to their time and circumstance and also according to their own particular vision. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives us the 10 things about which there is no disagreement, the dasamala. Those things, everybody agrees with them. There's a Supreme Lord, he's Krishna, there's a living entity, some living entities are conditioned, some living entities are liberated, the process is bhakti, the goal is prema. Those are the things about that we call the siddhanta, the ultimate end of perfection about which that everybody agrees. All right, anyway, those were some interesting things in the verse I thought we'd look at. And now we're going to purport. In the Kurma Purana, there is this statement about the desires of the demigods. Anandikarino devaha swargastha bharatod bhavan vanchatyatma vimokshartha mudirkarte dikarinaha. Although the demigods are situated in exalted positions in the heavenly planets, they nevertheless desire to descend to the land of Bharatvarsha on the planet Earth. This indicates that even the demigods are unfit to reside in Bharatvarsha. That's quite a statement. What did Prabhupada just say there? The demigods are unfit to reside in Bharatvarsha. Therefore, if persons already born in Bharatvarsha live like cats and dogs, not taking full advantage of their birth in this land, they are certainly unfortunate. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, my dear king, in the opinion of some learned scholars, 8 smaller islands surround Jambudvipa. When the sons of Maharaj Sagara were searching all over the world for their lost horse, they dug up the earth, and this way 8 adjoining islands came into existence. The names of these islands are Swanaprastha, Chandrasuka, Avartana, Ramanika, Mandharaharina, Panchajanya, Simhala, and Lanka. I'd like to do a little exploration here with the sentence and the verse. I was taught this way of studying Prabhupada's books by Krishna Dharma and his wife Chintamani in London. And they really took it very seriously when Prabhupada said, I want you to study my books threadbare, and I want you to examine every verse and every sentence from many different angles of vision. And they've been studying Prabhupada's books in this way for about 12 years. And I know Shri Ramaraj, when he goes to London, likes to go to their home and have a study session with them. So we're not going to do this for the whole verse of purport because it would take us a few days. But we can look at, like to look at this one sentence. And Prabhupada says, this indicates that even the demigods are unfit to reside in Bharatvarsha. Now what I'm going to ask us to do with this is separate two things. What we hear Prabhupada saying here and our reactions to it. In this way we can understand, one of the things I really like about this method of study, and I certainly don't do it on a regular basis, and it's hard to do by yourself, but one of the things I like about this method of study is one really understands that Shastra is Krishna and that the purports are Srila Prabhupada. You know, when I first saw Srila Prabhupada, it was in 74 in Chicago, and during the time Prabhupada was giving class, I was standing to his left, a little further than that vase would be, and I was fanning Prabhupada with a peacock feather fan the whole time. And at one of the realizations that I had was that having Prabhupada personally sitting on the Vyasasan giving class and hearing a tape recording of Prabhupada giving class were really the same experience. There was no difference in my experience whatsoever, which was both exciting and disappointing to me because I wanted there to be a difference. That's the rest of the story. That's also time, perhaps. But anyway, Krishna took care of that also. But I was also very engladdened and enlightened that even though I hadn't met Prabhupada before, I'd already gotten initiated through the mail, but I had been really with him just by listening to his tapes and reading his books. And that when Prabhupada left Chicago, I'd be able to be with him in the same way. That there really was no difference at all. I felt no difference. So this is a way of understanding that Srila Prabhupada is here in his purports. We can have a personal relationship with him. We can have a conversation with him. Now, when you have a conversation with the person, sometimes when we have a conversation with the person, we focus more on what we're going to respond than hearing what the other person is saying. And this is the cause, of course, of so many arguments and difficulties in the world. You're saying something, and I'm thinking, how am I going to reply? And I never really hear you. And, of course, each side is trying to be heard, but everybody's just thinking about their own response. So one difficulty we have, we were talking before about different understandings of Shastra, one way we really get things wrong, if we can talk about wrong, right and wrong, is to, instead of hearing what Shastra's saying, what Prabhupada's saying, we immediately jump to our reaction to it. And we think our interpretation or our realization or our reaction is the same as what's being said. Now, I will warn you, this is a little difficult thing to get, and it took me a while to get it, so be a little forgiving with yourself with how to get this. So what we're going to look at first is just what is Prabhupada saying here, not what I think about it, my realizations about it, my reaction to it, what does it mean in the greater picture, just what is Prabhupada saying. If any of you have done empathic listening, where you try to reflect back what the person is saying. So that's what we're going to do here. We're going to try to do some empathic listening with Prabhupada's purport. And then, after that, then we'll discuss what are our realizations about this sentence. We're just looking at this one sentence. Of course, we'll need to look at the sentence also in context because Prabhupada starts with the word this, which is a pronoun, an indefinite pronoun. And all pronouns must have an antecedent. It must have something that comes before. I can't just walk up to you and said, he's a really nice guy. The first question I'm going to ask is, who? Okay. So I can't just say, this indicates that. You're going to say, what indicates that? So to some extent, we may have to refer back to other sentences. Okay, I'm going to read this sentence again. This indicates that even the demigods are unfit to reside in Varsha. Okay? Does anybody want to suggest what is Prabhupada saying? Yes?
He's saying that what he just said,
okay, so he's
reinforcing what he just said.
He's reiterating what he just said. So what he just said about that the demigods want to come to Bharatvasa. So by saying that the demigods are unfit to come to Bharatvasa, that's a way of repeating that they want to come. Okay. Other ideas about what Prabhupada's saying here?
They want to come, but it's a bit difficult for them to come.
Okay, so Prabhupada's indicating that it's difficult. So he's enlarging on the previous, that's what I'm hearing you saying, right? He's enlarging on the previous thing. So previous thing said they want to come, and now by unfit, he's indicating that it's difficult. Okay? Are there ideas of what Prabhupada's saying? Yes?
He's suggesting that they're actually unqualified to be in Bhakti, but he's qualifying that statement with the indicator. So it's not saying black and white. This is a tendency.
Okay. Okay, so Prabhupada is saying that by unfit he means unqualified. They don't possess the qualifications, but he's not saying that about all the demigods. Other ideas of what Prabhupada's saying. This indicates that even the demigods are unfit to reside in Bharatvarsa. Are you saying it doesn't apply to everybody because of the word indicates?
It's just even the
demigods. Yeah, it's what we're talking about before, the different points of view.
Okay.
One point of view would say they're unfit, they're unqualified.
Okay.
But if you look at it from another perspective, that statement is incorrect.
In that case, if they are unfit, then who is fit to reside in Bharatvarsha?
Okay, that is a very good point. That holds for the realization. So that would be like our reaction to this. So our reaction to this would be, wait a minute, the demigod's unfit. Who else is unfit? How can anybody be fit? But I don't know if that's exactly what he's saying here. It seems like it's more an implication from here that you can... And this is my opinion. Somebody else might not say that it's a reaction. Somebody else in the ladies. There's not like a right or wrong to this. I'm not looking for one answer. Okay, so the use of the word even, that even the demigods are unfit. That shows that being taking birth on Bharatvarsha is very rare. Okay. Some more? Yes?
Just a question. When he says this indicates,
philosophical speculation is wanted.
This indicates even demigods. So when you look at it, the demigods are quite high. So then how do we expect ourselves?
Okay, this is very similar to Srinath's point. So, again, I feel that that's not like in this sentence, but it's sort of the next step.
So, in one sense, he says, if you're already in Bharatvarsha, don't waste your time.
Which is what he goes to in the next sentence. That's exactly what he goes to in the next sentence. He said, if you're already here, don't, you know, take advantage of it. So, that's Prabhupada's conclusion from this sentence. That's what he goes to from. Any other thoughts about what he's saying right here in this sentence? This indicates that even the demigods are unfit to reside in Bharatvarsha.
What is the sentence before that?
Okay? Although the demigods are situated in exalted positions in the heavenly planets, they nevertheless desire to descend to the land of Bharadvarsha on the planet Earth. Okay. To really reside, so that the demigods can visit, but they're unfit to reside. Or do you see a difference between maybe living and reside? It means to really. What do you see, Prabhupada, might mean by reside?
Visiting is like, for
a few days and residing. It's like me, I'm not fit to reside in Christchurch. I only get to visit. That there's a benefit. We think about that, of course, with Vrindavan and Mayapur. We think about, you know, somebody can visit, but to be able to reside there. Or the Durvasa Muni, who could come to the gate of Vaikuntha, but he couldn't live there, he couldn't enter into there. So that's probably talking about being able to live at Bharadvarsha. Some more. Any idea why Prabhupada, let's look at the word this, which refers to the previous sentence, that although they're highly qualified, they desire to come to Earth. Why does Prabhupada say that that indicates that they're unfit? What connection is he making with the word this, do you think?
That they have the desire, but they're not residing in Bharadvarsha. In spite of their exalted position, they're residing in the human planets.
Okay. So the fact that they're not residing shows that they're unfit. Any other ideas about why?
Because their desire to stay in the heavenly planets is more than the desire to actually live out the world.
Oh, very interesting. Very interesting. I like that. That although they have some desire to stay at Bharadvarsha, the fact that they're not, like if you're saying they're not in Bharadvarsha, indicates that they're not really fit. Because their desire to live in heaven, their desire to live in the heavenly planets is stronger. Okay. Now, what's our reaction to this sentence? We already brought up one here, that therefore it's pretty amazing that we're here. Some other reactions to this. Now I'll open it up. Any other realizations connecting this to anything else? How do you react to this sentence? Now we're giving our response to Srila Prabhupada. It's like we're having a conversation with Prabhupada. And now he's told us this. We've said, Prabhupada, did you mean this? Is this what you're saying? Is this what you're saying? And now we're giving our response.
My immediate emotional response to that was that the demigods are so absorbed in their higher level of sense gratification. That was my...
Okay. That the reason they're unfit is their absorption in their higher sense gratification. Other things?
That desire can be of different ways, how sincere is your desire?
That even though it said they have the desire... They're not automatically fit just because they have a desire. Therefore, the desire can be different intensities. Is that what you're saying? Somebody else, some reaction to this?
The position of the demigods is rather exalted, but they also have a relationship with Krishna on a different level, one perhaps an administrative level. And to be living in Bharadvarsha, which is on this planet, may not seem particularly inspiring to somebody with such a position.
That their exalted position, where they get to associate with Krishna as administrators, it may not seem so inspiring to come here. By the way, some idea about what Prabhupada means by Bharadvarsha?
The earth.
But it's interesting because he says here they desire to descend to the land of Bharadvarsha on the planet Earth. So maybe it's talking about India. It's not clear, is it? The land of Bharadvarsha on the planet Earth. Is that he's saying the whole planet Earth, or is he talking about India on the planet Earth? It could be talking about either. We know Bharadvarsha is used in different ways. Any other responses to this? Any other realizations, responses to this?
Because the islands have already been bifurcated, so he's honing in on India as part of it.
Okay, so that's how this is in relationship to the verse. So, because one may say, well, what does this have to do with the verse? And it has to do with the verse because we're talking about the creation of the islands, and therefore Prabhupada's concentrating on ours. Okay? Other realizations about this? Yes.
On one hand, it's like, oh, I'm here in Bharatbhaj, assuming that this means the earth. And even the demigods are unfit. So I don't have to envy them because they, you know. And the flip side of that, of course, is, oh, here I am, but I'm better than the demigods.
Okay, so what I think what I hear you saying is that we don't have to envy the demigods because they want to come here. But then we can also run into this thing and saying, I'm better than the demigods. Actually, I run into this quite a lot in ISKCON. I run into a lot of preaching who say, preachers who say, you can only go back to Godhead from the earth planet. You know, and of course, some people say you can only go back to Godhead from India. You know, and that's that kind of mentality. Actually, you can go back to Godhead from any position. There's no material impediment to going back to Godhead. You can go back to Godhead if you're one of the gurus in the hellish planets. You know, there's, of course, there's certain circumstances that are more favorable than others. But certainly there's no impediment. Well, it's really interesting to look at why the demigods who are in a higher position would want to come to a lower place. You know, whereas people on this planet mostly want to go to heaven. I mean, how many people on the earth don't want to go to heaven? There are some people who really want to go to hell. I met them. And they, I'm not talking just the fact that they like to do sinful activities, but they really want to go to hell. I saw some of them at the Woodstock Festival in Poland when we were going around with our Harinam. And some of these guys, they were dressed in all black, and they had they had decorated their faces and bodies to look like Yamadutas and Gurus. You know, you wonder if they took the paintings from the Bhagavatam with the hellish planets and put it in front of their makeup mirror, you know? It was amazing. And they were playing some music, and I really put that in quotes as we went by, that sounded like wolves growling. I mean, it wasn't even sound. It wasn't even anything that was remotely like rah, rah. It was bizarre. It sounds like the hounds of hell, you know? And that they actively want to be in hell. That's what they desire. C.S. Lewis says that in hell there's neither music nor silence, but only noise. So there are some people who definitely want to go to hell. You know, people who spend a lot of money to watch horror movies.
More
rises. they want to go to hell. They want to see people being you know, we have the descriptions in the Bhagavatam of the tortures, people are being dismembered, and they want to see that. I don't know if they want a person to be dismembered, but you know, they at least want to see other people being dismembered. So there are certainly people who want to go to hell, but most human beings, majority of human beings, would like to go to heaven. That's why you have a tourist industry here in New Zealand, because people think coming here is like heaven. I think the time before last, when I left Hawaii to come here, there was an elderly couple behind me in line, and we were talking about why we're going to New Zealand, and they said, we're going there because we heard it's very beautiful. And I thought, it's not as beautiful as Hawaii. Hawaii, you live in Hawaii, you live in New Zealand. But this is this idea, right? Or whenever I tell people that two of my kids live in Hawaii, people go, wow. Actually, just a place. It's a pretty place. It's a warm place. It's a pretty place. Just a place. And there's mosquitoes, and there's envious people. Rains a lot. Sometimes. But people are anxious like that. Or when I went to Trinidad, which is a Caribbean island, actually the climate in Trinidad is very much like Fiji. And I remember so many of the devotees there saying that they wanted to go to New York. And I said, what will you do in New York? You become a taxi cab driver. You have to live in the slums. And it snows there, and the snow turns black in a couple hours from all the exhaust. And here you're living in a tropical paradise, where for the Sunday feast, everybody got a cup of fresh passion fruit juice. I said, in America, we've got to pay, you know, $4 a bottle for passion fruit juice. And you got the passion fruit juice growing right outside your house. The whole Sunday feast was fresh organic food right under the devotee's garden. The whole feast. And they wanted to go to New York. And I said, you know where the people in New York want to go? Where do the people in New York want to go? They want to go to Trinidad. But everyone's thinking they want to go to heaven. They're all thinking somebody thinks Trinidad is heaven, somebody thinks New York is heaven. People in general think America's heaven. It's not, folks. It's not much different than Christchurch, really and truly. You know, people are thinking like that. I'm going to go to this place and it's going to be like heaven. Whether they're, you know, whatever their idea is, it's going to be better. My standard of enjoyment is going to be higher. I'm going to get more money. I'm going to have a nicer place, whatever. So everybody's anxious to go to heaven. And therefore people are going, you know, this way, that way, on this planet. And they're engaging in religious activities, hoping they'll go to heaven. But here we find that the people who are actually in heaven, the real thing, not just Trinidad where it's humid, you know, or New York where the snow turns black, but the real thing, they want to come to Gaura-Prasha. Now, they're not so foolish like the Trinidadians who want to go to New York. They're not in some illusion. Why do they want to come to Gaura-Prasha? What advantage do they have in Gaura-Prasha? They can go back to Godhead from the heavenly planet. And they're engaged, according to Sanatana Goswami, Riha Bhagavatamrita, they're engaged in sacrifice. They even see the Lord as Upendra in the higher planets.
So easy.
It's shorter. It's easier. Why is it easier here? Why is spiritual perfection easier here? Lord Chaitanya made it easier. And of course, Krishna has very sweet lila on this planet, especially in India. By the way, some devotees say Krishna only appeared in India. That is not true. Look in the fourth canto of the Bhagavad Gita. It's in the purport either to Yadayada, Yadama, Sarah, Purchanaya, Sarana, which one of those? Where Prabhupada says that Krishna does not appear only on Indian soil. So there you go. But Krishna does certainly display very sweet pastimes in India, on this planet, that are not displayed anyplace else, anywhere else in the universe. And Krishna's coming as the Yajna Purushas, Vamanday, but as far as Krishna coming as Krishna and stealing butter and, you know, eating clay and dancing on Kaliya, he only shows that here. And you know, when Krishna is showing it here, the demigods all gather in the sky to watch. Right? When Krishna is dancing on Kali or doing his Rasalila, the demigods are playing instruments and singing to accompany and showering flowers and marching. So they not only want to watch, they want to participate. They want to participate in Krishna's sweet lila, they want to participate in Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's lila, which they can't really do on the heavenly planets. I mean, of course, there's some lilas that go on at the heavenly planet. So there's the battle on the shore of the ocean of milk where they're riding on red-faced monkeys and white-faced monkeys and jackals and deformed human beings and all sorts of interesting things. And, you know, Lord Vishnu's there and then Mohini Murti comes and cuts off Rahu's head. So there's some lila that goes on in the heavenly planets. But not the same kind of sweet lila. Not the kind of lila that goes on in this planet is, in most respects, the same as the lila that goes on in Goloka Vrindavan. And that's not true of the other planets in this universe. So you can only get that here. You can't get that anyplace else. And there's also some facility here because there's not as many distractions. Do you ever have a job to get done and you go to a place where there's not so many distractions, even though it's not as nice of a place? You ever do that? They say that children who are easily distractible, who have like attention deficit disorder, shouldn't be in a classroom with lots of things on the walls. There shouldn't be lots of different colors and posters, and because then they'll just be looking around the room and they won't be able to focus on their task at hand. So many of us, we want to get something done. We have an office we go to with just a chair and a desk. We don't have any food in there. You know, we don't have a lot of distracting this and that. Maybe we turn off our phone. Right? If somebody really wants to get something done, like this one devotee friend of mine who's a business person, and I think once a month or so, he takes a weekend off and just leaves everything. Goes to some place, doesn't tell anybody where he's going, doesn't take his computer, doesn't take his mobile phone. I said, what do? He said, I just chant and read Prabhupada's books, and I do some planning. No distractions. So the demigods also want to come here because there's no distractions. The heavenly planets, there's a lot of distractions. And there's a lot of, when the Vodhi Akendra does this country western music, and he has this really funny song called Sometimes I'm Happy Here. And he lists all the miseries of the world, and he says, but then sometimes I'm happy here. Right? Wow, today's a good day. So the demigods have lots of good days. You know, we maybe have a few minutes here and there. I often ask audiences, have you ever had 1 week of pure material happiness? With no distress, no anxiety, no difficulty for 1 week. They've not yet had a person raise their hand. And I've asked thousands and thousands of people this question. What about 1 day? Have you gone for 24 hours with absolutely no suffering, just material happiness? 24 hours. I haven't even had anybody say yes to that one. But the demigods have lots of good weeks. So they really have whole days and whole weeks where their anxiety is either non-existent or very minimal. The threefold miseries are much reduced there. It's a distraction. They can think, I'm happy here. I can just be Krishna's servant and I can be happy here. And Krishna will allow somebody to do that. Sometimes people say Krishna makes everything miserable to push us to leave. But really, you know, if you want to be so-called happy in the material world and be a devotee, you can be. People sometimes ask that question, right? Why can't I have sense gratification and Krishna consciousness? You can. Go to the higher planets. You can do that. And if you've got good kids back on earth doing pindi for you, you can stay there for a long time, at least until Lord Brahma goes to sleep or until he dies. Then you can take birth there again. The problem is, of course, there's no such thing as pure material happiness. Doesn't matter on what planet you're on. But that's the nature of the happiness we're looking for. It's not Krishna's fault. And the other thing is that if one's engaged in material happiness, one cannot fully have one's relationship with Krishna. Because again, it's the nature of the thing. I can't both fully think on this body and on the enjoyer and fully think that Krishna's the enjoyer. It just doesn't work. But anyway, one can have a semblance of that on the higher planets. So therefore they want to come here. They find that here is more conducive. And going to a place where they're not distracted. So the tendency is probably there. Probably, I mean. Maybe not, but probably there, in at least some of us, that we also really want to go to heaven. You know, really, Bhakti Gyanaraj talks about this with, his name is Mavida. He was at some relationship to the story of the Maharaj Yudhisthira's Rajasuya Yajna in the Mahabharata. And there was this Mavida who was very, his name was Mavida, something like that, who was a very pious fellow, always giving in charity. Extraordinary charity. One of those things like Ranti Dev, where he gave away the last food to a guest. And so Indra's chariot came in front of him and said, okay, you can go to the heavenly planets. You're so qualified. Come on, let's go. And he says, why don't you tell me about it first? Somebody just comes up and says, hey, come to my place. Yeah, you might have been asking, what's it like? Just get in a car with strangers and drive someplace to an unknown destination. So he's describing how wonderful it is. Everybody's young, everybody's happy, and they drink somras, and the food's really good. And you know. And then Mavida says, can I stay there forever? And he says, well, at a certain point, your garland fades. And when your garland fades, you know that it's going to be time to go. You've run out of your karma coins. You know, you've taken everything out of your karmic bank account. Of course, if you keep doing good karma there, you can stay there. Or if you have someone doing good karma on your behalf, you can stay there. But generally, they don't do that. Just like people don't generally go to Hawaii and earn money. They usually go to Hawaii and spend money. And then when their money's running out, they have to come back and earn some more. You can make money in Hawaii. Obviously, people do. But that's not the general mood of going there. So he said, the heavenly messenger said, your garland will fade and then you'll come back to earth. And Mother said, well, I'm not really interested then. He said, I want to go someplace where it's permanent. But Bhakti Gyanaraj was saying, you know, how many of us would have that same intelligence? He talked about, like, at a feast, you know, somebody comes by with your favorite vegetable and you don't want to seem like a pig. So you go, no, 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 it's okay, I won't take it anymore. And after they've gone by, you're thinking, darn, you should take it. if the heavenly chariot came down right here when everybody else is looking and said, would you want to go to heaven? You say, no, I want pure devotional service. But if the heavenly planet, if the heavenly chariot came and nobody else was around, would you get in it? And many times our idea of going back to Godhead is an idea of going to heaven. We're thinking, you know, I'll go there and then there'll be eternal enjoyment. We're thinking of going to Goloka Vrindavan like going to the ultimate swarga. So that desire is generally there, and the two things desire, bhukti and mukti. Generally we want, bhukti is the positive, I want material happiness, and mukti is the negative, I don't want material distress. Which are very similar, but not exactly the same. You know, I don't want to be in pain. You know, my neck's hurting. How's your neck, by the way? Is anybody getting there? So your neck's hurting, and your back's hurting, and my head's hurting. And we're thinking, oh, it'd be nice if I could just get rid of this pain. That's mukti. We're not thinking, what do we positively want? We're just thinking what we want to get rid of. If only my back would stop. And the bhukti is, well, if only I had a really healthy, supple back, and I could, you know, do Olympic jumps. So it's really looking at the same thing. So these desires are there in the heart of the conditioned soul, and therefore we're given this instruction that, you know, even those people who really are in heaven, they want to come where we are. Just remembering, you know, in the early days of ISKCON, they were really preaching about brahmachari, brahmachari life. Don't. A deep, dark pit. And certainly don't have children. And your spiritual life is finished. So that was the preaching. And somehow or other, in spite of that preaching, by Krishna's trick, I got married and had kids. But I always thought I was really in mine. Of course it wasn't mine, I'm still mine, but that's another story. Anyway, so I remember I would go out on book distribution. That's my two children. My eldest child was in the ashram, and my daughter was not even 1 year old. So I was going out on book distribution, and I was always lamenting. Why did I get married? It should have been like this brahmachari. Who can just do books all day? I can only do books for 4 hours a day. One day, it was the Christmas marathon, and in the evening, after doing books, we would all sit together and hear Krishna book and drink hot milk. Oh, for those days. That was nice. That was nice. Anyway, so we were sitting there. My daughter was just about a year old, and as we were sitting there listening to Krishna book, she said, "Hi, Dita, hi, Dita, 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 hi, 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 Mama, hi, Mama, 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 hi, hi." That was the first time she chanted all. And all the ladies, it was all ladies in the room, they all went, "Oh!" And the next day, I was called to the town president's office. He said, "You are not allowed to bring your child into the sankirtan room in the evening for Krishna book and hot milk." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because now all the women want to get married and have babies." And that really helped me. I thought, I mean, I wasn't really very happy with that, and I didn't go out on sankirtan very long after that. I just didn't have the enthusiasm without the sangha. But I thought, why am I hankering for someone else's position when they're hankering for my position? I'm envying them and they're envying me. What a foolish waste of time. So why hanker to be in heaven when the people in heaven want to come here? Silly, huh? What a waste of energy. And we hanker for heaven even in little ways. Trying to make our little domicile heaven. You know, I mean, it's nice to plant a nice garden for Krishna, but if you're thinking, I want to enjoy. I was complaining to somebody about how dirty it is in Vrindavan, and someone said, "Do you care about it for Krishna or because you want to live in a clean place? Are you looking for heaven or are you trying to serve Krishna?" I said, "Oops." So sometimes we have that mentality, you know, let me somehow try and get as much sorghum in my life as I can. Instead, what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to be grateful. And Srila Prabhupada gave a really nice seminar recently in Auckland about empiric research on what brings people happiness, even material happiness. And one of the keys was gratitude. The people who were grateful were happier. So our tendency is not to be grateful. Our tendency is to focus on what's wrong in our life and to think that someone else has a better position someplace else. So this is a little indication, even the demigods, don't have the advantage that you have. And Prabhupada says here, if you don't take advantage of what you have, then you're really unfortunate, certainly unfortunate. You know, I had a little kid chanting Hare Krishna. Why didn't I just be grateful for that? So it's good to look at what we have, not what we don't have. And it's very nice. Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, in his purport to Brahmasamhita, I think it's text 61, talks about the process for attaining Krishna for those who are not already on the state of bhava. So if you're already on the state of bhava, you can listen to this for preaching strategy. And if you're not already in bhava, then maybe it's nice, applicable. And he says a number of things, but one of the points that he makes says one should use one's propensity in Krishna's service. But he sees what says one should see everything in life as the prasadam of the Lord. And of course, that also means the miseries, to be grateful for the miseries, to obtain kapan, to offer more obeisances to the Lord when the miseries come, to have gratitude for them. It's explained just like a doctor puts a stinging ointment in the eye to cure your eye. You know, when you went to get the treatment for your neck, I'm sure some of the treatments also hurt, right? But you don't punch the doctor. You might feel like punching the doctor, but you know, right? Or you just had surgery. Surgery is painful. Drilling into your body. You know, generally, if I came with a drill and said, "Hey, Pranathuru, can I drill into your knee?" You'd have me arrested. But when the doctor comes and says, "You know, I'm going to drill into your knee," what do they call it? Keyhole? Right? Keyhole surgery. So they must have, like, drilled the keyhole into your knee. Very small hole. Even a small hole. Look at how small it is. If I took a pin, you know, these guys, there's a needle right there. If I said, "Can I take that needle and make a small hole?" It would be very small. But when it's done by the doctor, you appreciate. You're grateful. You pay the doctor. Right? Somebody pays the doctor. Comes out of your wages or whatever. You go to the doctor. You voluntarily go. You voluntarily go to the doctor, you pay the doctor, you thank the doctor for putting a hole in your knee. So one should be grateful to Krishna. No, one should be grateful to Krishna. We're the ones who created our situation of suffering. We're the ones who came here and made a mess out of things. And it's going to take us some difficulty to get out. You know, you jump in a well and you're stuck in the well, and somebody pulling you out might hurt a little bit. That's not the fault of the person pulling you out. It's your fault for jumping in the well. So, you know, even the scrapes and the scratches of being pulled out of the material world means I'm getting out. And therefore the devotee is grateful for that. What to speak of being grateful for the positive things? And sometimes I find devotees are really afraid to be grateful to Krishna for the positive things in their life. It's like they want to just say, everything's nasty. If I'm really a devotee, I just say everything's nasty. It's not all nasty, folks. It's Krishna's mercy, just like this garland. How many people in Christ Church, other than the Hare Krishna devotees, have ever worn a garland of flowers? Is it a common thing? People get to wear flowers? Have you ever given a garland to a non-devotee and seen their reaction? I remember when I was going to university, it was one of the students' birthdays, and I brought her, it happened to be the day after Radhastami, so I brought her Radharani's garland, all red roses. She was completely overwhelmed. She said, "No one's ever given me a necklace of roses before. We get to wear these all the time. What about the food we eat? How many people eat food as good as we eat?" I don't know, maybe your cooks don't know how good your cooks are. At least on Balaram's appearance day, how many people eat like that? Hardly anybody, especially in modern society. Yeah. My son runs a prasadam business in California. They make these little health bars. And he was telling me that generally the food sitting on the supermarket shelf is between 6 months to 12 months old. And that's a good reason to do your own cooking. But, you know, how do they keep it seeming like food? They put all these preservatives in it. That's what most people are eating. Or they're eating food in some restaurant. I used to work in a hotel kitchen. The mentality of the people working in those places is not very good. Now, that's the kind of food most people are eating. Food made with low-class ingredients, old, by people who don't care about you. You know, the guy cooking in the restaurant, he doesn't care about you. He just wants to make money, not like your mommy or something. And we're getting to eat food made with love by people who really care about us. It's of the freshest, most wonderful ingredients because we're thinking we're offering to Krishna, and that Krishna has tasted. And that's what Krishna gives us. He gives us flower garlands. He gives us samosas. And you know what, folks? We're in jail here. This is a prison. Now, most governments don't give prisoners flowers. You ever heard of prisoners getting flowers? Imagine a prison where there's flowers. Prisoners get to go walk around with flower garlands and where they get to eat samosas. Who does that? This is, by the way, some evidence that God is actually good. So how kind he is. And therefore we develop an attitude of gratitude. Attitude of gratitude. Or as people say, gratitude means great attitude. And to always be seeing everything is Krishna's prasad. Everything is Krishna's prasad. I mean, this, you know, I don't know about the body you guys have, but my body is not such a pleasant place to live in most of the time. On rare occasions, it's slightly pleasant for a couple seconds. But generally, it's not very pleasant. But, you know, it's a human body. It's a human body. It's a human body on the earth planet. It's a human body on the earth planet at a time when Prabhupada was on the planet and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was on the planet. That's pretty good. I remember I was always lamenting that I had an American body and a female body. I thought, you know, those Indian men, they got mad. I was in a class once given by Dr. Chiru Maharaj. Funny Indian men laughing. Maybe she has no idea, you know, we also suffer. Anyway, I was in a class given by Bhakti Chuswami, and he's talking about the blind man and the lame man, and which is a theme he speaks about, especially a lot in London, where there's a lot of Indians who've grown up in the West. And he's talking about the Indians who've grown up in the West exemplify this blind man and lame man in their own bodies. They have the best of the West and the best of India. And he was talking about the benefits of each. He was talking about the benefits of India, and he was talking about the benefits of the West. And I thought, there's actually some benefits to the West. I may be blind, but I can walk. And I thought, there's really some benefits. Prabhupada saw benefits in me. He saw benefits of having Westerners become devotees and then preaching to the world. And I thought, I also kind of exemplify that. I'm sort of a mixed of East and West myself. Look at that. That was the first time I ever thought, yeah, I can do some service as a New York lady. There's some benefit to it. That I have something I can offer Lord Chaitanya. As a nutty American woman, one devotee said to me, she said, yeah, we Germans are strong. I said, what are Americans? She was quiet for a long time. And she said, loud and confident. I said, you mean loud and arrogant? So, you know, but there's some benefit. There's some benefit. People are looking up to Americans, and more in the world, people are looking up to women. More and more in the world, women are taking leadership positions. But there's some benefit to saying, here, I'm an American woman, I'm a New York American woman, and I'm chanting Hare Krishna. So to be grateful, even for the things that seem like they're not favorable, be grateful for the body one has, be grateful for the family one has, for the place that one lives, for the associates one has. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati says that I'm grateful for people who criticize me. I see them as somebody helping me to take shelter of Krishna. And certainly be grateful for the nice things that Krishna gives us. Prabhupada says, just like a person who's running a business, they may say to their employee, here's something for you to enjoy. If the boss says to the employee, here, you've worked so hard, you can go on a vacation. What does the boss want? Thank you. I was just reading where someone posted this thing saying, love is only to give, not to receive. I said, no. There are 6 loving exchanges, and 3 of them are about giving, and 3 are about receiving. This gratitude is about receiving. And part of the way we show our love for Krishna is receiving. The mood with which we receive. That the good things in our life, we say, Krishna, you're so kind. Although I'm so fallen, although I'm a prisoner, you've given me flowers, you've given me samosas, you've given me friends. You've given me your holy name. You've given me the Shastra. And the things that appear to be bad, hey, you know, you're just making a keyhole surgery in my knee to take care of the problem. Thank you very much. I know it hurts to have my knee drilled into, but, you know, you're solving my problem. Thank you. And you're solving the problem I created. Thank you very much. And, of course, we demonstrate this gratitude in our attitude, but also then in our behavior. If someone's giving me so much, as Prabhupada says in Purport to 15:15, God is all good, God is all merciful, then naturally I want to engage in the other three loving exchanges, which are to give. And by having this attitude of gratitude, we really increase our love for Krishna. We really started thinking, yeah, I really love this Krishna. He's really wonderful. How kind he is. How munificent he is. And then we really want to dedicate ourselves to him now, here, without waiting to have some heavenly situation here or someplace. Well, I've gone way over the time that I wanted to go. So, should I take questions or should I stop? Well, we'll do it until 8:25 right now, so we need to take Srinivas to soccer practice.
Saturday. I don't think I'm going to work. Just Srinivas got to go to play soccer.
That's important. Okay, any questions, comments, discussions? Yes?
I don't know how relevant it is. I thought, you know, it's the doctor who's performing surgery. But there's another person in that little scenario who's extremely important, and that's the anesthetist.
Sometimes it seems like Krishna performs surgery without anesthesia. Is that what you're saying?
It's the anesthetist who makes the whole the surgery tolerable, because obviously you couldn't lie there without anesthetic and have the surgery. So I'm just trying to think, if the doctor is the person who's performing the surgery in that analogy, who is the anesthetist?
In teachings of Lord Kapila, Srila Prabhupada, who's giving the anesthesia? Okay, so Krishna's doing the surgery, who's giving the anesthesia? Because you don't want to do surgery without anesthesia. That's not nice. Sometimes it's necessary. Sometimes the patient is allergic to anesthesia or whatever. But Prabhupada tells in teachings of Lord Kapila, he says that even an ordinary person can situate his mind in such a way that he's not disturbed even by the pain of a surgical operation. He said when Stalin had his surgery, he didn't take any anesthesia. He was afraid somebody would kill him. And he was able not to feel the pain without anesthesia. Now, Stalin is not a devotee. He's not even a nice guy. So the ability to create your own anesthesia is there in each of us, if it's there in Stalin. It's not that one has to be a pure devotee in order to create one's anesthesia. Now, I read that when I was pregnant with my second child. And I thought, I really didn't like labor the first time around. And Prabhupada's saying here that one can put one's mind in such a way that one cannot feel the pain even of a surgical operation. I thought, I'm going to do that. And I did it. I did it. And I had an experience with that labor where I was hyper aware of what my body was doing, but I didn't code it as pain. It was just interesting. Muscles are working like that. That's really interesting. I did not experience it as pain. And a devotee recently sent me something from an impersonalist who was talking about the same thing. He said, when you see the oneness of everything, then everything just becomes holy and interesting. And he said, you don't experience pain in the same way. Now, I can't say that I do this all the time with all kinds of pain, but I do know at least that it's possible. And how did I do that? I did that. I had a very interesting lesson in how to do it. What does it mean? First of all, what I did was I focused on the deities. There were Radha Govinda in there. And I focused on Govinda's belt. Of course, I couldn't see them. I wasn't giving birth in the temple room. I was giving birth in the temple. I was upstairs. We lived in the temple then. My daughter has told me many times, she said that she'd hear me say to people that, you know, my daughter was born in the temple. And she always had this picture of the temple room. Temple room. All right, but anyway, suddenly I was in the temple room. So my physical body was up on the ninth floor of the old 55th Street temple, which is gone, unfortunately. But I was in the temple room, and I was looking at the deities, and I was especially looking at Govinda's belt. And just like the deities here wearing the beads, so Radha women are very large, and they have jewelry that's really, really large. The beads are about yay big. And really, I think if we saw the jewelry off the deity, we'd say it was kind of gaudy. Anyway, it looks really nice on Govinda. And he had this belt of these big beads, like several strands, like three strands coming together, and then some coming down in the middle. And I can still see them. Anytime I can still see Govinda's belt. I was just fixed on Govinda's belt. I was determined. I thought, I am not going to go through what I went through that first time. I don't care. You know, I'm not going to do whatever I can do. I was fixed. Completely fixed. Third time, I was just laughing. The third baby. I found out you didn't have to be so like heavy. But I was just kind of meditating on Govinda's belt. And I was just seeing the beat. And I told myself, as long as I meditate on Govinda's belt, there won't be any discomfort. And I've met a medical doctor who had abdominal surgery, very serious emergency surgery, just with hypnosis. He didn't take any anesthesia. She showed me the newspaper reports about it, so I don't think she was making it up. She was a medical doctor. So that can be done. So our anesthesia is primarily an attitude of gratitude and a meditation on Krishna. On the absolute level, there is no, this whole idea of pain and pleasure materially is an illusion. What is pain? What is pleasure? It's just electrical impulses in the brain. That's all it is. Why do we interpret some of them as painful and some of them as pleasurable? That's our interpretation. You know why we interpret some of them as painful and some of them as pleasurable? Why do we feel pain? Because we're attached. That's why. We're attached. And I always give the example that, you know, if you go to a shop where they're selling televisions and they're showing a movie and someone in the movie is getting killed, you don't feel any pain. But if you're watching the movie, if you're attached to the movie, if you're absorbed in the movie, you'll feel pain. Or you drive by the street and there's been a car accident and somebody's being carried off into an ambulance. Do you cry? Generally? Is it painful? But if you notice it was your mother's car and you pull over and it's your mother being brought in the ambulance, that's painful. Why? Attachment. Every day so many people are, you know, right now, there's people in the world being raped. And tortured, and killed, and robbed. Why aren't we all crying? You can read about it in the newspaper. Do you cry every time you read the headlines? Oh my God, someone just got killed by a road bomb in Iraq. Oh my God. Why? But if it was your kid, you'd cry. Why? Where's the pain coming from? Attachment. One of the most profound things that was said to me, I had a miscarriage with my fourth child. And I was really grieving for a while. And the midwife said to me, you're not grieving for the child, you're grieving for how you projected that child into your life. And then I was attached. You start to think, okay, you know, the child's going to be born, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. I'm going to enjoy this way. I'm enjoying it. And it was all taken away. So that's where our pain comes from. Really. Therefore, if we're attached to Krishna, literally, if we're focusing on Krishna, and we give up our attachment, there's no pain. And having both done it and not done it, I know that it's very, very difficult to give up the attachment. We want to be attached. We want to be attached. We are having the pain because we want to be attached. So the fact that there's no anesthesia is our responsibility 100%. And we can have anesthesia if we want it. In fact, you can go beyond anesthesia. You can go beyond anesthesia to intense, deep joy when the surgery is taking place. Very overwhelming, exploding joy. Have I experienced this all the time? No. Have I experienced? Oh, yeah. And more and more, actually. Ravindra Srupabhu explains this very nicely in an outline he wrote about japa, which I advise you to check that out. It's on this site called So It Happens, and click on japa. And he talks about that as we're engaged in the process, then Krishna is removing the anarthas. And the anarthas are our false ego. They make up our false ego, like something's made up of Legos. You know, our false ego is made up of anarthas. That's what it consists of. So as Krishna is pulling out the anarthas, he's dissolving our false ego. Now, if I think the false ego is me, if I think that's who I am, then I'm going to feel that is very painful. Oh my God, Krishna's taking away my identity. He's taking away my source of pleasure. He's taking away my shelters. But as one goes on chanting, one starts to see, hey, I'm not this false ego. I'm a soul. And then you want to get rid of the false ego. And then it becomes delightful. It becomes not just neutral. It becomes actually delightful. It becomes very pleasurable. And one starts praying to Krishna, give me more. Speed it up. Don't do that artificially, please. But one comes to a point where one starts saying, okay, Krishna, disable the false ego. Whatever it takes. If I have to see that I'm a demon, okay, I want to see that I'm a demon. If everybody hates me, okay, fine. If it means I become crippled and poor and, you know, whatever it takes to disable this false ego, let's go for it. And I want to be with you again. I want to serve you again. The faster we can do it, the better. Die. So it comes to that. If you ask Krishna to go faster than you're really willing to go. Every time you're chanting Hare Krishna, you're asking. But you need to be honest with Krishna. That's usually from pride. I had one devotee contact me and say, mother-in-law, things are going really slowly in my spiritual life. I really don't feel like I'm making a whole lot of advancement. I feel like I'm just sort of treading water. I'm not going forward. And in the course of the conversation, he said, I've been praying to Krishna to take it easy on me. I said, well, what do you expect? He said, you asked Krishna to make very slow advancement. You told him you didn't want him to speed up the process. You told him to go easy on you. So, and then you're surprised that you're hardly making any progress. That's what you asked for. I said, are you willing now to ask for something else? He said, I don't know. I'm scared. I said, well, you've got to decide. It's up to you. Do you want Krishna to go slowly? And then you'd slow. And then you're in that long in-between stage where you're neither a fool nor a transcendentalist, where you have neither material nor spiritual happiness. Unsteady devotional service problem. And stay there for a long time. Say you can stay there for lifetimes if you want. There's not going to force you to go back to God in this lifetime. Or you can say hurry it up, but hurry it up means hurry it up. That's what it means. It's going to hurt at first. Come to our attach. We've got to decide that. That's something we're deciding, and we're deciding that minute by minute by minute, and don't do it. Don't say something artificially. Don't go to Krishna artificially and say, yes, hurry it up, when you're thinking, oh my God, if it was always going to happen, oh my God. Because then what he'll do is he'll just take one of your anarthas and shake it a little bit. You go, oh no. Is that what surrender means? Forget it. You nasty Krishna. He said, would you just ask me? He said, I'm not surrendering. Don't do it artificially. I think most of us have done it artificially, especially in the beginning. good. Helpful.
How do you be honest without justifying your own self and being proud? Like I've heard a statement, don't imitate Haridas Thakur.
So I understand the question being justification. If you want to go from here to Jnanavasa's house, you have to know where here is. You're not justifying where you are. You're justifying where you are. It's where you are. Who cares why it is where you are? I'm here because it's the best place to be. I mean, it's just silly. You're just there. It's not like I'm here, oh, it's so bad that I'm here. Oh my God, I'm so bold that I'm here. Or it's not, oh, where I am is such a great place. I'm so glad that I'm here. That's where you are. And if you want to know when you go out of the road, do you turn right or left? You have to know where you are. If someone calls you up and says, I'd like to come to your house, what's the first question you ask them? Where are you coming from? It's not a whole emotional, psychological question. You don't want them to say, well, I'm coming from this place and it's the best place to be and I'm really proud of being here. That's not the answer you want. Or you want someone to say, well, this is where I am. I know it's really far away. I'm so sorry about how far away it is. You don't care how far away they are. You're trying to give them directions. So you have to know where you are. Because where you are determines, depending on where you are, you may turn right or left or go straight. And that depends on where you are. So people are coming to your house from different directions. Probably told this to my father in Chicago about many planes coming to Chicago. We're all going back to Godhead, but we're starting at somewhat different places. We're starting at a somewhat different distance, and we're starting at a somewhat different angle. And you cannot make progress unless you know where you are. Impossible. If you pretend to be someplace further along than you are, you'll make the wrong turn. If you say, you know, I say I want to come to your house, and you ask me where I am, and I want to make it sound better, so I say that actually I'm closer, you'll give me the wrong directions. You'll tell me to turn left, when actually I'm supposed to turn right, and I'll never get there. Or if out of false humility I say that I'm further away than I am, you'll also give me the wrong directions. We don't have to tell everybody in the world where we are. We usually should tell God where we are. He already knows where we are, for a sense. And he thinks it's awfully silly when we pretend to be closer or pretend to be further away than we are. Now, the point of knowing where you are is not to be where you are. The point of knowing where you are is to know where to take the next step. So it's not, well, this is where I am, this is where I am, you know, I'm just honest about where I am. No, that's not the purpose of knowing that information. It's not so you can stay there. The feast is at Sri Puri's house, and you're supposed to get there on time. Not just revel in your address. So one's honest about where one's at, so you can understand where to take the next step, and so you're willing to take guidance from guru and devotees about how to take the next step. That's the purpose. Is that right? We have to stop now. And tomorrow we'll be looking at demigods. Tomorrow's purport is very, 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 very well. We'll be looking at the difference between demigods and Vishnu. And I haven't yet decided what I'm going to do for tomorrow afternoon. If you guys have any suggestions, suggestions will be taken. I'm sorry I went so late. I hope this was all right.
Do a play.
You want me to do a play? A one-woman play?
Well, you're already doing it.
I'm already doing it, she says. Huh. I have never done that for the Sunday feast class. One-woman play. It would be a new... I've done many interesting things, but not that one. Thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. All glories to the Christ Church devotees.